Good morning, and you've joined the Morning Voice. You're listening to 1030, trusted local news and talk, and the Morning Voice, 5 days, 5 hosts, 5 different conversations. I want to start today's show by thanking Matt Neely for sitting in for me last week. I tell you, Matt, it was really kind of a unique experience to be sitting across the other side of the country and listening to your voice running what was an incredible show. I thought the guests you had on were amazing, and I was really taken back by the whole concept of what it would look like if we actually started using military power against the cartels in Mexico.
Right, and it was maybe a somewhat controversial discussion and opinion that Bill Buport had, but if you stop and think about it, we don't always think about the second or third order of effects of doing things. And while it would be, you know, satisfying to see a fentanyl factory explode, you know, and that's the great headline, look what we did. And you know, I'm not saying they're good or we should somehow coddle them, but you do need to think about, you know, okay, what's the second, third, fourth order effects of all this? And I thought that he posited some interesting theories, and I thought it would be interesting for discussion on the show.
Oh, I think it's a great topic. It's a great consideration, because way too often we think really short term on, oh, that'd be a powerful statement, that'd be a great action. But there's going to be reactions. There's going to be other, as you pointed out, ramifications.
Yeah.
And I look at that, it's really one of these odd situations. We've talked so often about the military force and what our true military force, and as a a long 34-year veteran, we need to always be very diligent in when we use it and who it is we're targeting. And when we start targeting other things than actual military constructs, which we have, that's I'm not saying that there's not great examples of that throughout time, but you got to be careful. And I do think the uniqueness of the relationship we have with Mexico and the uniqueness we have the relationship with Canada, it's a little different.
Right.
So I thought it was incredibly fascinating.
And on this side of the equation, we need to do everything we can to deal with the demand signal. And that was Bill's thing. And his whole background is, you know, military strategic planning, studying insurgency and counterinsurgency. That's his focus. That's his perspective. Now he says, look, I'm not in a... Excuse me, I'm not in a position to talk about how to deal with the demand signal on this side of the border, but that is something that also, in concert with any sort of interdiction and all that stuff, has to be addressed.
And to that point, that means we need to deal with all the... Where's the demand signal? If you look at the demand signal for fentanyl coming from, you know, I may be completely naive, but I don't know how many folks who are looking just to take a one-time high are using fentanyl. You don't hear about it being found in people's homes for their recreational use. Again, I could be naive.
No, you're right. And Greg and I kind of talked about that after Bill, after the segment, is, you know, you kind of started with doctors and Purdue Pharmaceutical and the whole OxyContin thing and Vicodin and all. Oh, these are a new class of drugs. They're not addictive. You know, this treats pain. They don't worry, they're not addictive. Doctors were prescribing them freely. All of a sudden, they realized that they had a lot of addicted people. Then the government says, hey, kind of throttle back on your prescriptions. And so then you had people that were legitimately using them for chronic pain turning to heroin. And then they started putting fentanyl in the heroin, and it's this insidious cycle. Now I can't even, I think it was called ISO or something. There's like a super fentanyl that's like 20 to 100 times stronger than fentanyl out there that's starting to hit into the drug supply. So good grief. I mean, you do have people that were not just looking for kicks, that they were treating chronic pain and they got addicted.
And so that's the part of the discussion we never have a conversation about. How do we address the demand signal? Katie and I flew back in on Friday, 4:30 in the afternoon, got in our car down at TIA, started driving home, got off at Miracle Mile, turned up Flowing Wells, and literally I pull up to the stoplight at Flowing Wells and Roger, Circle K on the right southeast corner.
Sure.
Bus stop right there. And as I turned to talk to her, I said, are you kidding me? And sitting on the bus stop right there, there was one person bent over in what I call the fentanyl rocking chair, where they're folded over and they're just rocking. The two people next to that individual, one's digging in their pockets, pulling stuff out, and the other one's got a piece of foil and they're lighting. I mean, we're just staring at it.
Broad daylight. Not even trying to hide it.
4:30. We can't claim we're addressing the demand signal if we're not addressing the problem. We have come to accept this in the city of Tucson and in Pima County. I won't just say it's in the city of Tucson. It is throughout the county. We've accepted that open use of illegal narcotics is something we're not going to address.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that time we go back and I know, well, we're going to have Michael Guyman on here in about 10 minutes. And we're going to talk about 414 and what the next steps are. And at that moment, it just hit us as, what is it when you're driving around Tucson? Now, there's a lot of the great things about that we like about Tucson. We've got a thriving downtown that's starting to be vibrant. But when the question I want to start hearing answered is the question is, what is it that makes us proud of Tucson when we're driving around? And when we're driving around and seeing it. And the reason that's important is because that's what the folks that visit Tucson see. There may be great things that are being done in the city, but if they're not visible, it doesn't sell our community. And interesting enough, there was an article that I was reminded of that, or not an article, a quote I was reminded of that was part of Imagine Greater Tucson. And that's, you know, 13, 14, 15 years ago. We're going to dust this off though, take a look at what's in there, see if we've made any strides. But more importantly, the quote was, the reality of Tucson, when we say Tucson, what we're talking about the city of Tucson, we're talking about Oro Valley, we're talking about Marana, we're talking about Streator, we're talking about all of the unincorporated.
The region carries the brand, absolutely.
The region carries the brand. You don't, when I was in Florida on, you know, out having a good time and talking to somebody and they said, where are you from? I said, I'm from Tucson. I didn't tell them I live in Oro Valley. They'd have no idea where that was.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to embrace it as the region is the brand. And right now the brand, Ted's opinion, the brand of Tucson, when you drive around and you look and you see what we see and you see what is it that makes us proud when we're driving through town? How often do we have people call into any of these shows or to make a comment that I was driving down and I saw this and I was really proud to be a Tucsonan? That's the question I want people to start answering. And that includes, I'm going to actually ask all the members of the mayor and council, what is it individually, not going to do it in public. There's a time and a place to do these questions.
Sure.
Individually, what is it that makes you think is what shows that we're proud to be Tucsonans? Now, I've got a sense everything they're going to tell me are going to be little programs here, stuff you don't see. But we're missing the big picture. We're missing what makes investment in this community viable. How do you address poverty, jobs, and opportunities? There's so many things, Matt, I think we're not addressing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this gets back to what one of the other guests I had on, Frankie Antonori, Cochise County Supervisor, and he said, look, you know, I don't think it's a perception that I have, but he said the roads in Cochise County are a mess. And he says, look, the farmers know how to deal with the water issues. They can, as a collective, they can figure a lot of this stuff out, but the county government is spending a lot of time forcing solutions down their throats that maybe they don't, you know, that they don't think is the right solution for them. Right. Well, at the same time, he's like, do what you're supposed to do. You know, public safety and roads, do what you're supposed to. You know, I can't as a private citizen with my neighborhood do our roads, and you can't have this hopscotch, you know, road quality throughout the city. That's why you pay an entity like a city or a county or a region, right, to do. But then there are other things that come up that the city, I think, feels like they have to inject themselves into, or that government entities in general think they need to inject themselves into. And that's, I think, where they get lost. And I think that's where they get off brand. I think if you're driving around and you see streets that are well-maintained and sidewalks and streetlights that work and people not breaking the law in flagrant violation in the open air, I think people would have a different impression of what they see.
It's impressions.
And that's what we pay the government to do.
It's impressions. And to Frank's point, public safety and roads. I don't think there's any of the folks that are in elected office that will tell you the responsibility as a municipality is to ensure the safety of its citizens first and foremost. So I think as we bring on Michael Guyman here after our break, we will hit into some of those next steps. Mayor Romero was very clear. She wants to hear what we believe the solutions are. And I think the solutions were a lot of the talking points used during the campaign. And so we're going to bring that out. What we believe still important is the city and the elected officials have to be part of making the decisions. We will give them what we believe the priorities are. We will give them how they can get those funding for priorities. We're going to do some deep dives into the budget and try to work with them on that those general funds. But the fact of the matter is, if they're expecting us to start telling them what to cut and what not, that's what they're elected for.
Thank you.
And they are going to need to make those tough decisions. But what's paramount is they use the charter as their North Star, and they provide a safe and vibrant city. That's what they asked for with more money, but they need to be held accountable that it's their responsibility.
Right.
We will work with them, but to come back afterwards, after a campaign of opposition and say, okay, now we want to know what your solutions are. If we start telling you what to cut, you're going to turn all the people, all 70% of us who are against you for a lot of different reasons, you're going to turn us against each other, and then nothing's going to get done.
Right. 70-30. This is not a 52-48 kind of vote.
Absolutely. So it looks like you just picked up the phone. I assume we've got Michael Guyman on the line ready to go. Why don't we take a break? You're listening to The Morning Voice on 10:30 a.m. Trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back. You are listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. I have Matt Neely behind the glass. I've got still some more questions, Matt, about your show last week. Well, we'll save that till after our next guest. But they came to me as we were just talking real quickly in the hallway. But Matt Neely, behind the glass, keeping us on time and on target, which is sometimes the biggest challenge of this show. And right now we are joined via the phone by Michael Guyman, the president and CEO of the Tucson Metro Chamber of Commerce. So, Michael, I'm not sure how many times you're going to get to hear that in the next coming month.
Yeah. Well, good morning, General Maxwell. It's good to chat with you on the radio. Sorry I couldn't be there in the studio. But, yeah, I have this title for about two more weeks. So let's use it while I can.
Absolutely. If this is your last radio appearance under the guise of running the Metro Chamber of Commerce, I just want to say thank you for all you've done there. I think you've gone in, you've made an impact to the chamber, obviously, with it resulting in a merger coming up with the Sun Corridor. You had elevated both the financial stability and kind of the impact the chamber was having. And more importantly, I want to thank you and the chamber for playing the role you did in the Prop 414 campaign. Through the use of your PAC, you really stepped up and worked collaboratively. This was what I would call a non-traditional no campaign in so many sense, but without having the chamber and your ability to use the PAC for entities that wanted to support that no message and then oversee a lot of what was going on, this couldn't have happened. So well done on that. And I don't want to spend too much time taking the congratulations, but I do think it was worth mentioning the role that the chamber played.
Well, thank you so much, Ted. I appreciate that. And you were there at the very beginning. In fact, SALC taking the first position was a really big deal, and I don't want people to forget that. But we were then able to take that position against 414 and able to use the PAC in a way, but in a positive way. But, I think this also goes to the strength of the coalition that we built. And you're right. We were kind of a ragtag group of individuals who came together, who have varying levels of campaign experience. But when you put the, I guess, eight of us together, we just became a super consultant. And the nice thing too, Ted, is that combination of individuals, sometimes, especially in a campaign where everything is very, sometimes high stress and at a very high level, people get on each other's nerves. But there was not one argument during this entire process. And I think that just goes to our professionalism. It goes to our ability to work together. And it really goes to our ability to to ultimately sell what we had to sell to the voters, and we're obviously very successful.
Well, I think one of the big impacts on it was it wasn't even just the business community. There were so many different entities throughout the city of Tucson that found fault with the idea of asking for more money, which didn't appear that it would be significant enough to solve, definitely not solve any issues. But I think the common thread was you talked to everybody, if it's the housing advocates, if it was the homeless advocates, if it was the healthcare advocates, if, obviously if it was the business entities, even the public safety folks would acknowledge, while yes, the money would help, it wasn't going to make what was termed a significant impact. And I think the voter population eventually just understood that.
I agree with that, Ted, but I would also say that, because, you know, I knocked on doors, some of the other individuals that were a part of the campaign knocked on doors, and the big messages I received, without really saying much, to be quite frank, was the city needs to live within its means, within its $2.4 billion budget, and that they just weren't ready at this point in time to pay more taxes. And so, of course, our messages that related to this being a regressive tax, I think that all was certainly an important part of the mix. But again, it's just time and time again, I was hearing from people who said, enough is enough. Let's live within our means. Let's figure this out without having to raise taxes. And to the point you made about a diverse coalition, you know, we had former Democrat and Republican city council members. We had current and former Democratic legislators. We had union representatives. We had community representatives. We had business representatives. We all came together under that premise that these taxes are too high, and that, to your point, that this wouldn't really solve the problem. And that really gets to the conversations that we were having. And I say we as the royal we, you know, including SALC and others, prior to this being even placed on the ballot, of let's do this in a much more concentrated way. Let's actually sit down and figure this out. And we were asking lots of questions. We were putting some options on the table. We were there ready to have the conversation. And then with a flick of a switch, the council put this on the ballot. And once they put it on the ballot, that changed the narrative and that changed the story. And it changed our ability to have a real conversation, because now it was something concrete and we had to react to that concrete thing. So we had to jump into campaign mode, and that stopped all of the conversations that we were having up until that point.
Well, I think that's very important. And I think one of the things coming out of this, at least I know from speaking for SALCs perhaps, and I guarantee my understanding of the direction that the Chamber of Southern Arizona is going to move as well, is we need to stay engaged. We need to stay engaged. We need to stay at the table. We need to show up. I mean, for a long time, I think the business community's gotten, I'll use the air quotes of tired, of showing up, making our statements, and then being just discounted. So if they want us to come with solutions and ideas and be vocal, I think it's important. I know we've already been attending all of the budget processes since the budget for 2026 process started. And we're going to be there, as I know you will and other organizations. I think it's important for everybody in the community to realize, if you're not there being active and voicing your opinion, then if they choose to ignore you, it's a little harder to say, wait a minute. And I think that's something that the chamber did throughout this campaign, was to emphasize that you really didn't listen. And I think the other side also supported that as well. A lot of people have said the mayor and council ignored the input from the community. Now, we still all disagree what should be on it, but that's why I think business entities like us are going back to the charter. Look at what's in the charter. That's your roles and responsibilities.
Yeah, I really appreciate that point, Ted. That is the next point of this conversation. The charter does specifically outline what the priorities should be. And if the charter is really going to be the North Star, which is a term that I took from you because you said that right before the break, if the charter is really going to be the North Star, then you do those things well And then if there is money left over, you take care of some of those other priorities. This is not to say, though, that, you know, if the city applies for grants for certain things, then, you know, they obviously should go after that. And I think they've done a good job with that. I think part of the problem then becomes, if you do that, you need to also make sure that you put aside dollars to maintain those projects that you receive grants for, or at least work with other community partners to make sure that those projects can live in perpetuity. But it does start with the charter and the priorities outlined within the charter.
Michael, that's a great point and a great lead-in for the conversation we'll go into when we come back from the break, and that is, what is next? You've got to have the ability to sustain programs if you're going to stand them up. The city's been incredibly effective bringing federal dollars in and standing up programs, but that doesn't mean the money's going to continue to come, and that's a challenge. So thank you, Michael. Look forward to talking to you on the backside. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. So we're playing the Rolling Stones today, and I've got two other music aficionados on the line with me right now. So I'm going to assume, and now we're going to find out, that you've all, because assuming is always dangerous, that you've all seen the Stones. I saw the Stones for the first time in 1981 at Folsom Field in Colorado, where a group of us cadets skipped a football game to go up and see the Stones. We didn't get caught. We didn't get in trouble. And yes, I wasn't the best cadet in the world, but but we saw the Stones with George Thorogood and Hart. Matt Neely.
I have never seen the Stones.
Oh!
Never seen them.
See, that's why you never
assume
anything.
All the concerts
anything.
I've been to, I've never been there.
That's not why you never see me. All right, Michael Guyman from the Tucson Metro Chamber. Have you seen the Stones?
No, and I was going to say, Ted, you know, I can help you put some music on from like the last 10 years.
Wow.
Bam. We'll take that one as a frontal assault. That's all right. Well, Michael, next time you're on, I'm going to let you select the music.
I will take up that challenge. I love that.
All right. And if you do that, then I'm going to start posting pictures of you from high school and in your skateboard attire, too.
That's fine.
Yeah,
it's already out there.
I know it is, but you know, there's a lot of things that people don't know about Michael Guyman. I don't know how many people know you're a goalie in hockey, and we had a great conversation yesterday when we were doing a little next steps conversation about the role of the goalie on a hockey team, and I did learn that Michael says he does not cuss except on the ice.
That is true. So that is very true.
And I can't blame you for cussing on the ice, because the goalies, they don't always get all the love on the ice. So enough of our exploratory conversations about who we all are. So, Michael, you've got a lot of experience. You've worked in City Hall, you know, with Fred Ronstadt when he was a city council member. You've been part of MPA, Sun Corridor, the Chamber. Born, raised Tucson resident, you have a lot of experience here. So you've heard the call. The mayor has asked that we, those opposed, all the people in opposition, give her solution, the here in the council solutions. What do you see from your experience, and what do you think the best way forward for those of us who have said no more taxes, not right now?
Yeah,
is
yeah I. No, I appreciate that, Ted. And just for a little bit more context, I was Councilmember Fred Ronstadt's chief of staff, who served the Ward 6, the center of town, from 1997 to 2005. And during that time, we actually had to cut post 9/11 about $100 million out of the budget over a 2-year period. And I remember the council using their study sessions, where city manager James Keene put up easels. He said, okay, this side is the expense side, this side is the revenue side, and just mapped it all out. And it was really up to the council then to make those really hard cuts and adjustments. That ultimately did lead to the garbage fee, which was somewhat unpopular, but it was a revenue stream that wasn't being utilized and something that the council could do. You could argue that they ultimately paid the price for that, but as you noticed, that garbage fee has not gone away. So as unpopular as that position might have been, it was something that, a decision that they made that still lives today. Similarly, in 2012, which, you know, I was involved at another organization at that time. I was not working for the city at that time. But you look back at those memos, and this was coming after the Great Recession in 2008. And in 2012, you look back at those memos, and they had to cut $55 million out of the budget. So, you know, and they, again, both times they did that without raising the sales tax. So these conversations can be had and done. But what it really comes down to for me, Ted, is getting these people in a room. I feel like a lot of these conversations have been done in a vacuum. And, you know, they say that they sent out a survey, but if you really look at the results, about 380 people returned that survey. They say that they have these open houses, but it doesn't feel like when you go to these open houses, which you and I have been to, that it's a real conversation. It's about putting a bunch of post-it notes on a wall and then collecting that information and then going behind closed doors again to come up with some of these solutions. These really take real conversations. You know, we didn't create Rio Nuevo in a vacuum. Those were very, very challenging conversations that included a lot of angry merchants downtown who felt that their rents were going to get raised. But we had those conversations with those merchants out in the open because we knew that this project was important. Similarly, with these conversations, these should be in the open. These should be our ability to have real conversations and sit down with the leaders of our community and you know, not do it at call the audience, but to actually have sit-down conversations and put these solutions on the table. Are they going to accept all of them? No. But at least we can have that meaningful conversation to get to the next point.
And that's a great point. It is about having those discussions. But more importantly, what I really appreciate you bringing out is there are times that communities are faced with making cuts. And the fact that back in 2000 or in 97 and after that you mentioned, they looked at the revenue and the expense side. You've got to, when you're balancing a budget, you've got to look at both sides. The solution cannot just be, we need more money. And therefore, who are we going to get it from? From you. And the reason I say that's important, and people have missed this, is the city of Tucson's sales tax would have, the amount of sales tax charged in the city of Tucson, let's say it that way, would have been 50% higher than other parts in this region. That's not in a way to attract right. businesses. It's not in a way to attract right. growth. And I do believe, and I know as a business community leader, you are the same, that the way we address the issues of poverty, of crime, of homelessness, is through the creation of jobs and hopefully well-paying jobs and education. Those are the things we have to do. And until we're doing those and our communities safe, those other items, like you said, make sure you're funding your priorities. It's the other items that are the nice to haves that you can look at. And sometimes the economy just doesn't allow that.
Yeah. And to that point, because again, going back to 2005, we had 1,200 commissioned officers. And that was in a community that was lower in population, not too much lower, but it was lower in population when you compare that today. And today we have 750. So we went from 1,200 to 750. So that also needs to be a part of this mix because we know that money isn't going to solve all of these problems. We know that especially when it comes to public safety, it's more difficult today to recruit officers to take those really difficult and challenging positions. But with that said, money is certainly a part of this, needs to be a part of this conversation because the compensation that currently exists within the Tucson Police Department is pretty much at par with our surrounding jurisdictions and very not at par with the other, with the jurisdictions up north in Phoenix. And so if I'm an officer and I'm looking to to take it potentially an open position for the same pay in open Oral Valley and not have to deal with some of the day-to-day things that I'm doing in Tucson, I'm probably going to take that position. So we also do need to look at these compensation levels and make sure that, again, we are prioritizing this first and making sure that we address that before we go back out to the voters, whether it's for a sales tax increase or you name it.
Michael, that's a great point, because the city's got to acknowledge that the stress, the situations, the danger, the issues you're dealing with inside of the city of Tucson are not what police officers in the similar regional cities are. They are more similar to some of the issues you're going to see up north in Phoenix. It's not because we want to become Phoenix, we want to be like Phoenix in that area. It is about compensation is what people in life tend to move towards, and not always happily. There are people that want to be a member of the TPD and will and continue to serve with honor, accepting that their job's more difficult than some others they could have, and for their families, they're put at more risk. And we've got to compensate them for that. And I think that was the thing that was missing for us in the 414 public safety side was, yes, the capital yep. goods were there, but until it's, as we say in the military, boots on the ground, you're not going to solve the safety issues and the response times. You have to have officers available to respond.
Yeah, and to that point about capital needs, you know, we can look at other means to do that. We can look at bonding. You know, the county has gotten, I think, really creative with their PAYGO system and using other mechanisms to bond for capital. So we can bond for some of these other capital needs, but it does take money from the general fund to address some of these issues that relate to compensation, and we recognize that. But again, those conversations were happening up until the moment in time when the sales tax was placed on the ballot.
And I think it's important that people understand that organizations like yours, like mine, two organizations we have the honor of leading, we really are here to help. And I think if there's problems, you saw it again, you know, property tax was mentioned in a letter to the editor today. Use that. Well, the city says that they're restricted by state. Well, let's take a look at those restrictions. Let's take a look at other ways
exactly.
to do it. But to go to the sales tax just it was excessive and headed in the wrong direction. So I think the city needs to know those are the kind of solutions we may bring to the table and offer as we go forward. And I want to leave one thing. I don't want everybody out there to think that we're just always beating on the city and the fact that the city won't listen to some of the requests we have. On today's agenda, they are going to be taking up several changes through some of their policies, but they're going to be taking one to do with folks in the medians. And you talked about that yesterday. You sent me an email last night saying you had done a little bit more looking into that. And you believe that's a positive response to some input we gave them from a series of people, not just business communities, but we had unions, we had nonprofit support on a letter asking them to address that issue because it's so dangerous. And do you want to just talk about it a little before I let you go? I know you've got a meeting you got to be at momentarily.
Yeah, and to that point, because that's a great point, Ted, and we've been saying this all along, that the city does some very good things. This moment in time, as it relates to 414, we had to take a position. We took the position. We fought, and we won. Now let's get back to talking about things the city does well, and going after individuals on the median. That is a big problem. It's a problem that I hear about all the time, and I know it's a problem, an issue that they hear about all the time, and so. So looking at ways to solve that is a good thing. The community corridors tool to help flexibility in some of the zoning to allow for greater density. That's a great tool. There are things that the city is doing well. And again, historically, we have been working with them to create these valuable tools and ordinances and ways to effectively do the city. But this... Again, we just came to a moment in time where we had to say no at this point in time. But now we want to get back to how do we solve these problems? How do we do it collectively? How can the business community be there to help? And let's do it. Let's get it done.
Well, Michael Guymon, the voice of the Tucson Metro Chamber, president, CEO, maybe the last time you hear that on this show. But appreciate you joining me today. Look forward to having both you and Joe Snell on after the merger occurs to talk about the new direction for the Chamber of Southern Arizona. And have a great day, Michael. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Ted. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk, and we'll be right back. Stay with us to the top of the hour. Humberto Lopez is going to join us.
And remember, The Morning Voice has their eat and greet, meet and greet. It's on Thursday, 5:30 to 7 o'clock, Bamboo View Restaurant, 7018 East Golf Links. That's the southwest corner of Golf Links and Kolb. Look forward to seeing you there.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Your local, trusted local news and talk. Bert Lopez is going to be joining me at the top of the hour. He's here, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation. It's as part of the engagement hour. Thing we brought over from Jump in Tucson for the 2 hours of The Morning Voice was that I wanted the second hour to continue to be the engagement hour. We highlighted through people's stories how you can get involved and how you can do things for the community. So I'm really looking forward to my conversation with Mr. Lopez. But Matt, I told you I wanted to come back to a couple of questions. One, you're definitely on the my A-list substitute for as a host, because I was really impressed by the show and how you did it. So first off, did you tell Greg what music you wanted to play, or did you turn the
Greg.
Music control over to him?
Just let him do his thing. Yeah, we had, yep.
So you're telling me I could learn from that? And I should just turn it all over to you now?
we've done that too. So absolutely.
Absolutely. What was it like to be on this side of the microphone
again? It's been a while, and I felt rusty. Yeah, to be honest with you. It's a totally different approach. On this side, the announcements are a little tighter and scripted, and there it's free-flowing discussion, and you have to follow a conversation where it leads you, and I felt rusty. I'd been on that side of the glass a lot for about 7 years during the old show, but I definitely felt rusty.
Well, I know you made that comment, I think, after your first break or a long line, but it took you no time, because by the time you hit the second half of the morning hour, and then, well, you were rolling. I mean, with the interaction you had with the guests was perfect.
You're far too kind. I think we're all our own worst critics.
We all are. So I just want you to start making your list of guests to come on. And that's one thing. When you took over the show, I said it's yours. You know, when my guest hosts come in, I'm going to let them do that and pick who they want to bring on the air.
Well, you know, the show got off to a good start because I had on the Angels. You know, Angels. So that
made it.
That got
made
it off
easy.
On a good start.
That made it simple. So you're listening to The Morning Voice tomorrow. Grant Kruger will be on with a little mix of politics and food. And his guest will be Matt Quick, who just opened up his second location of Banchan Chicken on 4th Avenue. So make sure you turn in tomorrow morning for the Morning Voice. We'll be right back after the top of the hour break.
Humberto Lopez coming up right after the news.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I am Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, keeping us on time and target, as I like to say. And I'm extremely honored to welcome Humberto S. Lopez to KVOI. First time in the studios down in this way, Mr. Lopez?
That is correct.
Well, we're glad to have you here. The second hour of The Morning Voice on Tuesdays is the engagement hour. And the purpose of the engagement hour is to encourage everyone that's listening to get involved. We're nation bound by shared values of freedom, liberty, and equality. And with that comes some rights and some responsibilities. For some of us, that includes service to our country, others to our service community. And Mr. Lopez, on behalf, and that's, I'll go back to calling you Bert after that, but Mr.
All
Lopez,
right.
on behalf of the Tucson community, I want to say thank you for all you have done for the university, for the community, for the region, to try to make this area and the state a much better place. So I appreciate all you and your wife, Sarina, have done to give back and to lead this community towards better days.
Well, thank you, Ted. Well, first of all, let me tell you, I'm a firm believer that to those that much has been given, we have an obligation to give back. And that's exactly what I do. And excuse me for my voice this morning. Every morning when I get up, I have this hay fever, and I'm a little hoarse. So if I start coughing or sounding a little funny, let me know.
Well, those who listen know that I have no problem filling blank air. So, but the purpose of this thing is, I encourage people to get engaged, because there's a lot of different ways to do it. We've talked about doing it through nonprofits, doing it through public service, doing it through boards and commissions, through your church, through your community. It's just a matter that every one of us can make a difference. And I think you are a great example. And I do it through the storytelling of what brought there. And you grew up and were born in Mexico. Your dad, our father, I believe, was a farmer. And so can you kind of just talk us through your background and what brought you to Tucson?
Well, fortunately, I was born in Nogales, Arizona. My father was from Mexico, so my mother and father, they went to live in Mexico, so I grew up in Mexico up until the age of 12. When he passed, this was in Ciudad Obregón, Sonora, which is about a five-hour drive from Tucson to Ciudad Obregón, Sonora. So anyway, when he passed away, I was 12. I was the older of six. My mother came back to the States because her mother lived in Nogales, and also her brother. And we ended up moving in with my grandmother. I was the oldest of six, and my mother, so we were seven of us, and my uncle, her brother, lived at the house, and my grandmother. So we moved into this little house, one bathroom, three bedrooms, and all of a sudden there were three adults and six children. But we had a great life. I don't regret it. I would not change an instant growing up when I was 12 years old. So we came to the States. My father died without a will, and he was a farmer, rancher, did agriculture, and I'd say we were middle class. We lived very well. We had new cars, a nice house. I remember having my brother and I, we had our own horse. So we had a good life, and all of a sudden we end up with nothing, and my mother had to go and get welfare. So we grew up in welfare. I started working at the age of 12, selling newspapers, and I'd make a dollar. I remember that I'd buy two newspapers for 7 cents and sell each paper for 7 cents. So I doubled my money every time I sold two papers. And I'd make a dollar, and I'd give my mother the full dollar. Then later on in life, I started knocking on doors of neighbors. They knew that we needed help. And every time I knocked on doors, I would offer to cut the grass, to weed their garden. And then later on, I started asking if they needed to paint their house, a bedroom, or a part of the house. And absolutely everybody gave me a little job. When I turned 16, one of our neighbors was the manager of a grocery store. And I was of an age now that I could go to work. So he gave me a job at a small grocery store in Tucson, in Nogales. And I go to school from 8 to 3. At 3, I run over to the grocery store, get out at 10:30 at night, 6 days a week. I therefore don't remember how I ever did any homework. The only day I had off was Sundays. And I'd give my mother every penny I made. But at that age, since I was a little older, I remember I used to keep about $5 for my spending needs. So, and that's how I grew up that way. Never missing anything. Had a lot of fun growing up. Everybody in the neighborhood was poor. We didn't know that there were wealthy people out there taking vacations. And we didn't miss it. So had great friends. I still have some of those old friends. They're good friends of mine. We still see each other on occasion. So life has been good. I've been blessed beyond my dreams.
So it sounds like you've kind of instilled in yourself that work ethic that's led you to a lot of success and a lot of commitment to the communities.
You know, that's one thing. You cannot teach work ethic. I mentor a lot of young men and women, and I start out with one of my keys is hard work. But you cannot teach hard work. The worst combination is somebody who's very smart and lazy, because they're always looking for a way to get out of avoiding doing the work. So, no, hard work is the number one key in my book.
And so, after high school, what was your path through the universities?
Well, you know, my mother and none of my uncles and aunts went to high school. They never graduated. It turns out that their father had passed away also just around the Depression time, and they were all small. So they'll have to start working to help out the family. So my mother was never, could never give me any guidance. So I had to figure it out on my own. So when I graduated from high school, my counselor advised that I should go to a vocational school, learn how to be a plumber, an electrician, a carpenter, because he said I didn't have the grace to go to college. So consequently, he was right. What he didn't know is that I was working 44 hours a week and didn't have any time to do any homework. Whatever grace I got was whatever I learned in the classroom. So I enrolled at Cochise College, a junior college, took 18 credits, not knowing that 18 credits was a lot of work. And I would go to school in the morning, be in the library all afternoon. I'd put in 8 to 10 hours a day, just as if I was working. I graduated in 2 years without any problems, transferred to the university, and continued taking 18 credits. I could have graduated in 3 years. However, I went to full four years because I started taking accounting, and I don't know, accounting came very easy for me. So I took every accounting class that was available and graduated from the university with 144 credits, a lot more than I needed at that time, and had very good grades. But it was all based on the fact that I was working pretty hard and making sure that I got through school.
And Bert, I believe it was about 6 years after the university that you opened HSL Properties. You founded it.
Yes. Well, what happened is that when I graduated in 1969, I did not want to stay in Tucson. I was an accounting major. I did not want to stay in Tucson. And I don't know what it was that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to be able to help out the family. So I interviewed all the companies from Los Angeles. I'd never been, the furthest I'd been from Nogales was Tucson, and had never flown and never been out of Tucson and Nogales. So I interviewed a number of the Big Eight. Back then, it was a Big Eight.
The Big Eight. The accounting world's changed a little bit, hasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, there's a Big Four now. But so I interviewed just, I applied with all of them, and everyone that I applied for or with offered me a job and flew me to Los Angeles. I'd never been in an airplane. All of a sudden, I end up in Los Angeles working for Deloitte. Back in those days, it was Haskins Sales. Today is Deloitte. So I went out there with the idea that had I stayed in Arizona, I would have been a tax accountant. I did not want to be a tax accountant. I wanted to go into the audit field, figure out a business I could get into, even though I didn't have any money and I didn't know how I was going to do it. But I was determined that I was going to have a business of my own. So I went to Los Angeles and joined the audit practice and was auditing a number of different companies, so not knowing whether I was going to go into retail, manufacturing, real estate, and so forth. Turns out that I became a real estate expert, and a friend of mine at the time, who was one of the controllers of one of the firms I was auditing, loaned me a book, How to Turn $1,000 to $1 million. And that was back in 1971. I borrowed the $1,000. Of course, I was lost in Los Angeles, living with one of my cousins in Los Angeles. So, and at that time, I was married. I got married right after I went to Los Angeles. I got married. We've been married 56 years now.
Congratulations. That's true. That's part of the story is truly amazing.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, takes a lot of patience.
you're a wise man.
Well, you know, I say patience, patience, patience. When you run out of patience, you better find some more patience. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble.
No, absolutely. So it's 1971. You were still in Los Angeles, and I grew up in Whittier, California. So we were in the same area at that time. And you're just finding your way.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if we ever passed each other without knowing.
Yeah, I would have been a little tyke at the time.
Yes, you would have been. So anyway, I borrowed $1,000. From my uncle, I told him I'm going to pay you back with the income tax refund I was getting. Immediately I went down to Nogales because I did not know Los Angeles at that time, and called a friend of mine who was a real estate broker, a little older than I was, and went to see some property. So I ended up buying a residential lot for $3,000. The seller, as a matter of fact, seller bar engineers from Tucson carried back $2,000, and I was paying $100 a month, and $100 a month was a lot of money. And consequently, my wife, I had to put her in a very strict budget since we had to pay the $100 a month. Well, 6 months later, long-term capital gains used to be 6 months one day. 6 months one day, I sold a lot for $3,000 profit, plus I had paid my uncle the $1,000, so at $4,000. I immediately, well, in Nogales, I bought another lot, it was a little bigger lot, and 6 months and one day later, I sold it for a $6,000 profit. So in 1 year, I turned $1,000 into $10,000. Then I, at that point, there was a house and an apartment and a duplex that was available. I needed $15,000. So I borrowed $5,000 from my wife's grandfather, bought the house with a $15,000 down payment. And 6 months later, one day, I sold it for a $15,000 profit. So in a year and a half, I turned $1,000 into $1 million. The book How to Turn $1,000 into $1 million was all about leverage I can't think of the word, but I'll think of it in a minute. So anyway, I had $25,000. I was the National Guard at that point. When I graduated from college, I got drafted. Well, I did not want to go to Vietnam at the time because I had the family to help out. And at that point, I had already, well, no, I was not married. So I joined the National Guard and was serving in Los Angeles at the time. And most of the guards, the soldiers that were in my unit, they were all college graduates. So I was looking at a place I was going to place my $25,000, and I was able to, I had found an apartment complex, 30 units, that was being sold for $300,000.
Back in Los Angeles?
Back in Los Angeles, $10,000 per unit. So I was able to convince five of my buddies there that we used to meet once a month for the weekend, to each put up $5,000, five of them, the 25 plus, I put in $5,000. I told them, you'll get your money back first. I'll get it last. And we split the profits 50-50. Well, 6 months later, I sold the property for $100,000 profit. Under $25,000, I got to $25,000 back. They got $50,000, and my $5,000, I got $50,000. So in 2 years, I had turned $1,000 into $75,000, and I started buying and selling little properties.
Yeah.
And before I knew it, I was on my way.
I mean, that's such an incredible story of one, focus. You were definitely focused. You knew what you wanted to do. You figured out ways to do it. But before we go to the break, do you think that is still possible? Is there still the opportunities, specifically in real estate investing, for some of the folks who are graduating now and have this vision, and can that still be done?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, there were a lot of opportunities when there were a lot of foreclosures and properties for sale all over the place. There was a point that everybody thought they were going to make the money in real estate. So consequently, what was happening, all these new subdivisions, 20% of sales were being sold to investors. And the investors were mom and pops who were borrowing against their equity to buy a house or two. And at that point, I remember giving a little speech regarding that I saw the collapse of the market coming up. And the reason for that is that we're here, for instance, in Tucson, we're building 12,000 homes a year. Phoenix, we're building 60,000. 20% of those homes were being sold to mom and pop buyers who were using their equity to buy a second or third home. Well, what was happening in Tucson, we're growing at a rate of, I believe, $24,000. I mean, 24,000 people a year, I think, in dollars. Sorry about
that. It's hard to get away from.
And you divide it. The average household is 3 per family. You divide 24,000 by 3. There was a need for 8,000 residents. It could be houses or apartments.
Right.
We were building 12,000. We had an excess of 4,000. Eventually, right, those 4,000 units were going to come to the market. Phoenix was the same case. They were growing by about 120,000 divided by 3. That's 40. They were building 60,000 homes. Mm-hmm. So 20,000 homes were being overbuilt. They were being bought by mom and pops. When the market crashed, of course, all these units had been over several years have been overbuilt. Everybody put the properties in the market, and there was not the absorption for all those units. So consequently, everybody, my son-in-law was a president of the company that were building, I think 10,000 units per year. They went bankrupt. All these companies ended up going bankrupt. All the small mom and pops that were buying all these properties, not only did they lose the properties that they had bought, but they lost their own homes. Yeah. So there was a nexus of housing out there. These young men and women I was mentoring, I tell them, you know, when they ask me, how do you start? Very easy. You go out and buy some of these houses that you're buying for cents on the dollar, rent them out in the meantime. They're going to go up in value because they're going to be absorbed. That overbuilding is going to be absorbing. There's going to be a lot of money to be made. And there's a lot of money to be made. There's a lot of investors right now that buy houses, fix them up, rent them, and sell them.
And let's talk about that after the break, Bert, because I think some people look at the housing market and the investment in properties. They have doubts about the responsibilities and all that. But in reality, that's a way to build, I think, a balanced portfolio. And so we'll talk about that when we get back. That's the voice of Humberto S. Lopez, the founder of HSL Properties and a true community leader in Tucson. So we'll be right back after the break. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. This is the Morning Voice Engagement Hour. And my guest today is Humberto S. Lopez, the founder and of not only HSL Properties, but he also, with his wife Zarina, created the H.S. Lopez Family Foundation to facilitate some of your philanthropic efforts and what you've given back to the community. We'll get on that later. What I'd like to go on and to now is just hear a little bit, and I know, Bert, you know, we're up to about 3 minutes before we've got to go to the next break. But you've talked about how you got started, but how did the creation of HSL Properties and what you've done in this region, how did that develop and expand?
Well, so as I said, I was practicing at the time with Deloitte when I was doing my deals. I don't know why I didn't get fired. I should have been fired, because every time I was off, everybody knew when I was waiting to be assigned. It could be a few days. I was making calls, making deals, making offers, selling, buying, and my focus was in my business more than doing the audits. At that point, it was by 1977, I had made a lot of money. As a matter of fact, 1977, I promised myself, when I make my first million, I'll buy a Rolls Royce. So by 1977, I was driving a Rolls Royce.
You followed through with the promise. You bought one.
By 1975, I was driving a Mercedes, but by 1975, a Rolls Royce. Had a beach house, a boat. So did very well by 19. So anyway, going back to the book that I read, I forgot the inflation. Yeah. It was all about making money on leverage and inflation. And as you well know, we've had inflation all our lives.
Absolutely.
And we're going to continue to see inflation. Someday, I believe there's going to be hyperinflation, runaway inflation, because there's no way we can pay $36 trillion of debt. The only way you pay it, and the way the rest of the world has had these problems with too much debt, has been by hyperinflation. But by the dollar, the peso, whatever, being devalued and paying the debt with the old debt. So I think someday we're going to see it. There's no way you pay $36 trillion. The interest right now is more than the government's bringing in taxes. So,
and Bert, that's a great point. I fully agree with you. And at some point, that's the issue we got to deal with in the government. It's going to be painful.
It's going to be very painful. And inflation hurts everybody. The poor, the rich, everybody pays for it. It's a form of taxation.
Oh, no, that's absolutely true. When we come back, I'm going to kind of let you take the lead on what we talk about. And I would like to talk about both HSL Properties, some of the good investments. If you got some stories of some bad investments, the listeners always like to know not everything's roses. But I do want to talk about what you've given back to this community, what you've done at the university, your advocacy, and your Wildcat fandom, and hopefully we'll maybe even work in a little basketball. Who knows? But this has been an interview I greatly appreciate you taking the time to do.
Thank you.
I've really looked forward to hearing the story. I did not know you served in the military.
Yep, 6 years. I joined when I was 24 and I was going to get it at the age of 30. I said, God, I'm going to be an old man.
Well, you know, it's funny, and you just never know. You never know what the military is going to provide you. But I appreciate that service as well. That's a new side of Humberto S. Lopez I didn't know. And I really do appreciate you being on the radio with us today. If you're interested in calling in and asking Bert any questions, 520-790-2040 is the question. We will be back after the bottom of the hour break, and we look forward to you staying with us. You're listening to 1030 The Voice. There you go. The Stones from the 80s. That was the Start Me Up tour, the concert I referenced earlier I went to. So you're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell. I'm your host. Matt Neely's behind the glass, working both the radios and the phones. And my guest today during the engagement hour is Humberto S. Lopez. Bert, incredible sharing your story about how you saw an opportunity through hard work, through investment, through leverage. And of course, we mentioned, talked about the inflation piece, which is a side benefit, but the leverage. My father, till the day he passed away, was a crazy investor, investing in 3x ETFs, which are all leveraged, and then he had to go to you know, options, and because he believed in the theory of leverage. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it worked out for him, sometimes it didn't. He had a hard time selling. Easy time buying, but it sounded to me through your story, you've learned the value of not only investing, but then also selling and moving on to another issue. Has that played throughout your career, leading HSL Properties to get it to the point you are today?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's to me, it's inventory. And you know what inventory is for, to be able to sell it. Nowadays, we don't sell. We've just been accumulating properties. Everything we build, we keep it. They're going to be legacy properties. But when I started out, and I could not buy apartment complexes anymore in Los Angeles for $10,000, I started going outside of Los Angeles in California. So I came to Arizona. Very soon I was in New Mexico, Oklahoma, Texas, all the way up to Georgia, buying and selling. There were times that I leave the house and be gone 7 days a week doing deals. At that time, we had an only daughter. And one of my regrets is that I get up in the morning, she'd be sleeping. I come back home, she'd be sleeping, and then I'd be traveling. The only time I'd see her was on the weekends, Saturday or Sunday. But before we knew it, she was a grown-up lady, and I missed up spending time with her and taking her to games and enjoying time with my child, my daughter at the time. So that's my only regret in having worked so hard to get where I am today. So, yes, I was buying and selling. The minute I was getting the long-term capital gains, the property be sold, and made a lot of money that way. By 1979, I thought I'd made all the money in the world. I thought I'd retire, sold out, moved to Tucson in 1980. I was a multimillionaire at that point, and thought I'd, I was 34 years old. My wife was 29, and thought I'd learn how to play golf well. I was 34 and still had a lot of energy. Golf was too darn slow. I go out and play nine holes and tell the people I was playing with that I had some business to attend to. So consequently, I'm a horrible golfer.
I don't have the patience. I wouldn't say you're a horrible golfer. I've played with you and the pro-ams and some of the other ones. Yeah. And it's a difficult game to be very good at. Your investments, you were very good at. And there's always the thrill. You know, the thrill of the buy, the thrill of the sale. And as an accountant, I'm hearing all these accountant terms. And as you know, my wife Katie was an accountant in the private sector, and then she's now teaching at the University of Arizona in the accounting department. And very grateful for all you do for the accounting department, because you are a perfect example of an accounting degree can take you anywhere.
Absolutely, it's a great stepping stone. You know, people think that success is defined in wealth. You know, I've, of course, have been very successful beyond my dreams. And I tell these young men and women that I mentor, success is not necessarily defined in wealth. To me, success is finding your passion, where you never work a day in your life. If you're working, you better find another job and enjoy it. A teacher can be a lot more successful than a multimillionaire that's very unhappy. They could have inherited all that money and not happy at all. So find first and foremost your passion. to me, people ask me, how come you're still working? I said, who says I'm working? I love what I do. I still probably put 70, 80 hours a week, but I'm not working. I thoroughly enjoy what I do. My friends are all playing golf, and once in a while they talk me into going and playing, and I do play perhaps 2-3 times a month, and I'm horrible, but I enjoy being with my buddies and the outdoors, and I just wish I had more time. I'm in control of my time, but I love what I do.
And that, Bert, may be the biggest takeaway from the things that you've said today, is what you need to find is your passion.
Absolutely.
Make your passion your profession. And I think for some listeners and others, sometimes we get in a rut and think, well, this is all I can do. No, it's not. You need to pursue something you're passionate about, because then you're going to be doing it out of joy. I talk a lot about retiring in a couple of years, Bert, and people look at me and go, you're crazy. Well, as long as I enjoy what I'm doing, I'm going to find a way to keep doing it. And you have the opportunity to step away from the organization you've created, because you have an incredibly strong team at HSL. You have mentored, developed, you know, Jerry Fisher, Omar Morales, you know, the people that are close to you. You've got a lot of folks. HSL could run on its own, but you still do it because your business is your passion, and what you do, you enjoy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the case. Omar runs the company. I only have one person who reports to me. That's Omar. but the company is still 100% HSL Properties, Inc. still owned 100% by the H.S. Lopez Family Trust. So I still keep an eye on what's going on. I review every financial statement. I ask a lot of questions, and Omar comes and brings me up to date. And all I need is a few minutes of his time. I give approvals, buy, sell, refinance. But other than that, I don't get involved with the personnel. And that, to me, is the hardest part, managing people. So I never did that. I had my partner when I left Deloitte to form HSL Properties, Inc. in 1975, which, by the way, this year we're celebrating our 50th anniversary.
Another incredible stat.
Yes. we have 1,000 employees. None of our executives have ever left. If they leave, it's because they're retired. But we treat them well. We all respect each other. We're very professional. No gossiping. I don't believe in gossiping. But I do believe in the people working hard. And we have a very hardworking staff. Everybody enjoys what they're doing. Everybody does extremely well. But as I said, you know, if you don't like what you're doing, you're never going to make any money. And if you go into a business that you're not enjoying to make money, you're never going to make any money.
So everybody remember, you heard it here from Bert Lopez, find your passion, and if you're passionate, then you'll never work a day in your life because you'll be enjoying what you're doing. So you found another passion, and that is, you mentioned it earlier, those who have achieved much or been given much are responsible for giving back, and you've done that in spades through both in conjunction with your wife, Serena, and with the family trust. You've given back. Let's start and talk about the center of opportunity, because we talked about that.
Let me go back to the giving back. You know, since I started working at the age of 12 and giving that dollar to my mother, I've always been a giver. When I was working at the grocery store making $44 a week, I give $40 to my mother. I keep $4 or $5. So I've always been a giver, helping out my mother. So I made a pledge to my mother many years ago when she was in line waiting to get, back in those days, when you were welfare, you did not get food stamps. Okay. You went and got your food every month. So we ate the same food month after month after month. There's some of it that I don't need anymore, like Spam.
I understand that.
I've been a giver all my life. I can't remember a day that was not a giver. To this day, I help all the family. Every one of my brothers, sisters, they get a distribution every month. My wife's brothers and sisters, my mother, I took care of my mother, and my mother-in-law, who's going to be 94 now, she still gets help from me. So we've been doing that all our lives. In 2004, I formed the H.S. Lopez Family Foundation. So it's been around for about 20 years now. We've given many, many, many millions throughout the years. Our intention, my wife and I have made a pledge that 100% of our wealth is going to go to the foundation. Our children and grandchildren have been taken care of. each one of them has a trust. They'll be taken care of. They'll be taken care of. Middle class, they'll be taken care of. Well, they'll have a house, a car, some distribution for the trust. But if they want to be wealthy, they have to do it on their own. The money in the trust does not go to their children. If they want to pass on anything to the children, they have to make it themselves. They do, however, have an opportunity that the trust, if they put together a real business plan, not to siphon money out of the trust will invest in that business plan. Any of the profits are their profits. So they have an opportunity that I didn't have. They can start out if they want to make any, if they want to be successful. And, you know, if they want to be teachers or not work, they're going to be okay. But they're never going to be wealthy. The wealth goes to the foundation. They will be managing the money in the foundation to be given out to others. Because as I said, we pledge to give all our money. And at that point, when the time comes, I won't be paying any taxes because I don't want to give it to the government and put it away. So consequently, 100% goes to the foundation. We avoid paying any taxes. And they'll be able to distribute that money for many, many years, generations to come. So it'll be the largest foundation in Tucson for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And Bert, I was really taken because you spoke those words at the dedication for the HSL or the HS Lopez School of Business Analytics when the ribbon cutting occurred there. You on stage, you talked about that. You talked about there's a piece of everybody needs to earn their way. If they want to be millionaires, they've got opportunities. Mm-hmm. You provide them the opportunity, but they're going to have to work it.
Well, they're going to have to work.
And I think that's a big thing. But you've given back a lot to the community as well. There's several entities and organizations that you've established or funded over time. What are a couple of the ones that you are most proud of?
Well, as a matter of fact, this afternoon at 5 o'clock, we have a Family Foundation board meeting. And I think we have requests right now for over $1 million. We'll probably be awarding $500,000 today. I put a limit of $500,000 every quarter through the foundation. We give a lot more money through HSL Properties Inc. and the HS Family Trust. And I think it was 2017. Well, before that, several years ago, I've been in Phoenix to visit. It was called, today it's, God, I'm trying to recall, it was a homeless shelter, and it was CAS. CAS used to start Central Arizona Social Services. It was a homeless shelter. I toured the shelter. It looked like a homeless camp. What was happening there, the homeless would go in the morning, get their meal, go in the evenings, stay overnight. At 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, they'd have to go out, and they'd wait outside the fence waiting to be admitted again. They go back in for their meals, come back and wait on the outside. Pretty soon the outside looked like a homeless camp. The whole area got destroyed. However, what I like of what they were doing out there, they were providing 9 different services in one campus. And I don't know why the idea remained in my mind that if I ever had an opportunity, I would bring all these nonprofits into one campus where they would all operate under one location. I'm sorry. I apologize at the beginning. This happens to me throughout the day.
Bert, that's okay. Let's hold this thought. We'll cut to a break right now. But when we come back, I want to talk about that campus and what you've seen as the success. And we'll talk a little bit about the homeless situation in Tucson and how you see how we can make a dent, how we can make a difference, and how you followed through with that thought as well. So that's the voice of Humberto S. Lopez. He's our guest today on the Engagement Hour. You're listening to 10:30 The Voice, and we'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back. And I tell you, I've gotten a lot of satisfaction from today's show. So that's a great lead-in song. So my guest is Humberto S. Lopez. Bert, I really appreciate you joining us. It's been amazing. Learned a lot about you, and there's so much for that you've done for this community. Mr. Lopez was recognized in 2006 as the Arizona University of Arizona, or as by the Arizona Chamber of Commerce at the time, Man of the Year, and then he received the University of Arizona Hispanic Man of the Year award the following year. And then in 2022, you were recognized as the Alumni of the Year for the University of Arizona. And you've done some incredible things. We could do a whole nother show on what you've done for the university. But I want to go back to what you set up at the first part. Based on a visit you had to Phoenix and what you saw, you had a vision for bringing together all the nonprofits down here. So can you talk to us about how this creation of the Center for Opportunity came about?
Well, so anyway, I had pretty much forgotten about that visit. So when the old Holodome, which was the first convention hotel, was built in Tucson, it was 301 rooms, 8 acres, on 8 acres, 25,000 square feet of public space, came available. I immediately jumped in and bought it and closed in 10 days. So with the idea that when that property came up, I was going to turn it into a homeless shelter. Little did I know about running a homeless shelter. So the first thing I did, I contacted a number of nonprofits and offered them the property that I was looking at converting into a homeless shelter, and wanted to bring all the nonprofits into one campus. So all the services that were being provided to the homeless would be available in one place. Otherwise, what was happening in the past, they were spread throughout the city. A lot of these people that needed the services, that were given one appointment to another agency, most of the time they did make it. They're either walking, bicycle, or public transportation. So it was very difficult for them to be able to take advantage of the services that were being provided here in Tucson. So it became available immediately. I contacted a number of nonprofits. Everybody turned me down when they saw the size of the property. It was too much for anyone to handle. When it finally came down to Gospel Rescue Mission, they didn't believe that that property would be made available to them, as they were looking to, they were raising funds to build a little bigger facility. They had a 55-bed facility, men's shelter. They were providing, I think, 7 different services in that facility. So the idea was to treat these people with dignity, respect, and love, and also to be able to help them to go back and getting them integrated back into society, where they'd be working and providing for themselves. So we negotiated a deal. They were very hard. They drove me pretty hard. They ended up getting a 99-year lease at $1 a year. So
I'd say they did well on that one.
We entered into an agreement. Immediately, I got the architects to design the property into what I believe needed to be built there. So we built 5 different buildings. One of them remained empty for about 2 years. It was a training center. It took me 2 years to convince Pima Community College to come in and start teaching these guests of the center to get an education where they would be able to earn more money, get either construction, culinary, IT, truck driving, and so forth. And of course, you know, it's, once you graduate with any of those trades, you're making $25, $35 an hour.
And that's such a key thing, because you're giving them the skills to succeed. So we've got about 40 seconds more. So it's considered a higher barrier, but the success rate that you've seen of success for your graduates has been phenomenal.
Well, let me tell you, the only reason this works, unlike the government, and you said high barrier. High barrier is that we want these people to get educated, get trained, and help them find a job in housing. So we've done that very well. And the only reason for it is that Gospel Rescue Mission, who is the operator of the center, there's 53 nonprofits at the center. They don't take any public funds. Consequently, there's no reporting to the government.
And Bert, got to cut us off at this point because we're up against the hard break. Thank you for all you've done. Thank you for the Center of Opportunity. You are making a difference.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming on with me. We're going to have you back. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk.